I wouldn't say we fell in love right away. I think we were, as they call it in the biz, trauma bonding.
And then after 8 years of being insufferably sober, I started drinking again.
Addicts tend to be rather sensitive people.
Aren't you Marc Maron? I'm like, yeah. And she goes, what happened to you?
Hey, you guys, it's Anna David. You are listening to the podcast Recover Girl. I'm so glad you're listening. Let me welcome you to this show. If you're returning, freaking great. If you're new to the show, freaking also great. This is a podcast where I talk to people about addiction, recovery, and sharing their dark to find their light. I strongly believe we all have darkness and we all have stories to tell about it. It doesn't have to be about recovering from addiction to drugs and alcohol or anything else. It can be about recovering from illness, about anxiety, toxic relationships, take your pick. By the way, if you want to know, should I be telling my story? I mean, in books or articles or anything else, I have a quiz for you. Go to lighthustler.com/quiz. Do not go there right now if you're driving. Do you hear me? But later, go to Lighthustler, LIGHTHUSTLER. Yes, I can spell the name of my own site, lighthustler.com/quiz. Find out if you're one of the people who should be sharing your story. Speaking of that, this is such an exciting episode for me today. This is an interview like none other I have ever been able to do. It is with Austin Eubanks. Austin is a survivor of the Columbine shooting tragedy. He was shot twice. He watched his best friend be murdered right in front of him. And from there developed an addiction, unsurprisingly, and is now in recovery as COO of Foundry Treatment Center, speaks all over the world. Is one of the most articulate people I have ever had the pleasure of interviewing. And in this episode, you are going to learn how he has evidence that addiction can develop just from trauma, as in not from any genetic predisposition. He talks about what it was that got him to get sober, and he talks about what it's like to survive the one secret to working through trauma. So this is one you don't want to miss. You are hearing this. It is the day after Christmas. If you are downloading it the day it's available, this really, I'm not going to say, wow, this is so in the holiday spirit, but it can put some of our issues in perspective. Holidays is a time that can be challenging for a lot of us. You know, I don't know if you guys have ever heard that, alcoholism is a threefold disease, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. So if for some reason holidays aren't turning out like you think they should, or Santa didn't bring you what you wanted emotionally, because we're all adults here, listen to this episode. It will make you realize what we as human beings are capable of surviving, and that's really pretty much anything. So without further ado, I'm giving you Austin Eubanks. Hi, you guys. I am here. It's Anna David. I am here with Austin Eubanks. To my left, anyway, hi, he's here. You see his face. It says S.A. Banks, but it's Austin Eubanks. He's waving. And I'm so excited. This is obviously a completely different time than I ever do this. And that's because this is a very, very special guest. And this is my second Facebook Live this week. It's an embarrassment of riches, you guys. So if you are new to seeing who the hell I am, I'm Anna David. I am a New York Times bestselling author of 6 books. I'm in long-term recovery. I have a company called Light Hustler where I help people share their dark to find their light. And there is no better example than my guest today. So Austin Eubanks is somebody that we started emailing, I mean, only about 6 months ago, but I have been aware of who you are. I mean, I think since you came out about your recovery, which was about 6 years ago. In short, if you don't know who he is, he's an injured survivor of the Columbine shooting who developed an addiction and has devoted his life, is in recovery, is in long-term recovery, and has devoted his life to helping those people who suffer from addiction as a result of trauma. He's the COO of the Foundry Treatment Center. He speaks all over the world to
thousands and thousands of people about his recovery. And he's one of the greatest examples we have of a recovery advocate. So I'm so honored you're here. Thank you, Austin.
Thanks. Yeah, you made me sound a lot cooler than I am. So I appreciate that wonderful introduction. It's great to be here.
Please. So let's walk it back. And I told you before we started that I'm actually self-conscious asking you about Columbine because it just feels so cliched and because I know you've been asked about it so many times. But pretend you haven't ever been asked about it before. And can you describe the experience for us?
Yeah. So I was 17 years old and I had enrolled in Columbine in my freshman year as an out-of-district student. I was in the library meeting my best friend in order to prepare to go to lunch when the shooting started. Really the hardest part about the shooting for me was losing my best friend. So we were huddled together under the same table in the library. I was shot twice and he was murdered right in front of me. So as you can imagine, life took a hard left turn for me after that day. Up until that point at age 17, I had never smoked weed. I had never drank a beer. It just wasn't something that was prevalent in my family or my friend group. And almost immediately, I started to take prescription drugs off label in order to soothe the emotional pain. And that led to a pretty debilitating addiction, as addiction always does. My tolerance continued to build over time. And then after multiple attempts at treatment, I finally found lasting recovery at age 29.
So when that happened, you were in the library, you felt, where were you shot? In your leg?
My right hand and my left knee.
And you had no idea what was happening, or did you?
Well, you know, that's a great question. There's two places in life that you're always told you're safe, and that's home and school. And I still remember Corey was the first person who was sitting at our table who said, "That sounds like gunshots." And we all just immediately dismissed it as, well, it might sound like that, but it's not. We're at school. So why it wouldn't be gunshots? It's probably construction, or we wrote it off to, you know, a million other things that it could be. And it was about 5 minutes after he said that a teacher ran through the same doors we had just walked through into the library and yelled for everybody to get under the tables, that somebody had a gun. And there's actually a 911 audio recording of that teacher making a call from the library that's online that I've used in a number of settings when I talk about the way that trauma can impact people and the way it has ripple effects and can lead to addiction.
So you got out of there. How quickly afterwards did you get those pills, and how did you get the pills?
So I left the library about just a few minutes after Corey was murdered, and everybody started to get up to kind of scramble out the back doors because the perpetrators had left. And I went out the back doors. I was taken from that area to a triage area to get medical attention. And I remember the one of the most vivid memories that I have is my father jumping over a fence to be able to get to me. And I remember that was the first time I had this just emotional catharsis. Like I just went limp in his arms and I started, you know, screaming and crying, and rightfully so. I mean, that was the first step of the stages of grief that I should have been in. And it was about 30 minutes after that experience that I was heavily medicated on a variety of medications that were intended to sedate and to relieve pain. And I had no knowledge of what the medications were even supposed to do. All I knew, not having any awareness of addiction or how those drugs were going to affect my brain chemistry or how they were going to improve the symptoms of trauma and emotional pain, I started taking them because they made me feel better. And all I knew at that time was that a lot of highly educated people had prescribed me medications that were supposed to make me feel better, and they were working. And so I remember it was like every time I would take them, there would be like a warm blanket put over me. And so all of the senses and everything I was experiencing was just more dull. It wasn't as sharp. And I was drawn to that almost immediately. And it was just a matter of weeks before I started taking them off label. And then, you know, what started with prescriptions turned to alcohol, marijuana, illicit narcotics. I spiraled very, very quickly.
What were those pills, those initial ones?
So initially I was prescribed opiates, which was initially a 7.5 milligram hydrocodone. But when I left the hospital that day, I had a 30-day supply. So in retrospect, I probably could have done with 5 to 7 days and then gone to a non-narcotic. I left with a 30-day supply. I went back to a checkup with my primary care physician just 3 or 4 days later, and I got another 30-day prescription. I also had a prescription for sleep that was a benzo. And then it's important, too, I regressed the timeline just a bit because about 8 months before Columbine happened, I had developed this affinity for getting dropped off at school, and I would walk through the school and grab my golf clubs out the back door to the golf course instead of attending class. And so naturally, my grades started to slip. And in 1999, when your grades started to slip, that could only mean one thing. You had ADD. And right. So I went to the doctor. I got an ADD diagnosis because they're like, oh, yeah, he's not interested in school. He would rather play golf. That's definitely ADD. And they gave me a 90-day supply of 10 milligram Ritalin. Wow. And they said, here, take one a day, another half in the afternoon if you need to. And I remember that was the first mind-altering substance that I ever ingested. But I didn't like the way it made me feel. I remember I would take them very sporadically. It would make my hands feel weird. My mouth was dry. I couldn't eat. But the reason why I bring that up is after Columbine, I had a prescription for an opiate, a benzodiazepine, and a stimulant. And I learned very quickly with the combination of those three drugs that I could turn myself into a robot. I never had to feel anything. And I was drawn to that because I held on to this false core belief that because this profound tragedy happened to me, that I needed those medications in order to be successful. And it took me a long time to start to break down that core belief.
Not to mention every doctor would pull out a prescription pad for this kid who survived the biggest tragedy in the world. I mean, you had a free pass for the rest of your life if you wanted to get doctors to keep giving you drugs.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I always make a point to, I work a lot with doctors and dentists and prescribers today or around this education. And I always make a point to say that I don't believe that anybody who ever treated me had malicious intent. I don't think that they were saying, oh, look, we're just going to give this guy, you know, a ton of meds to get him addicted and it's going to ruin his life. It'll be great. They were doing what they were trained to do. They were trained to diagnose and prescribe. And now we know different and we're starting to turn the tide on the way people are approaching that. But one of the biggest issues that I had immediately after is there was no collaboration between the clinicians I was working with on mental health and the prescribers that were prescribing medications for the physical symptoms. There was no collaboration at all. And so that's something that I'm a big, big champion for, is I think that historically we've had just a huge lack of collaboration between physical health and mental health. And so I'm really proud of some of the projects that I'm getting to work on today in regards to helping develop prescribing collaboratives where people are coming together and saying, look, if we need to prescribe over 7 days of opiates, it's going to require a behavioral health evaluation. Right. And that's not intended to prevent somebody from getting the medications they need to improve their quality of life. It's intended to give them an education about, hey, look, maybe you broke your leg skiing, but what if you got divorced 3 weeks ago? Like, these are going to make you feel a lot better in more than just your broken leg. And that education is so, so important to help steer our society forward.
So important, especially today, because so many of the kids that are adults too, that are on heroin, were prescribed opiates by doctors trying to help them. And they're, you know, we don't tend to live in a society where people are talking about their feelings. I mean, more and more we do, but people are chiming in, and I'm so grateful. You know, I wanted to put Darlene's comment up here because she says they make money that way, getting someone hooked. Now, my feeling is that, like what you were saying, Austin, 96% of doctors have their hearts in the right places, but I know because I've experienced the 4% that do not. I had a psychiatrist before I got sober who, knew I was a drug addict, who knew that I was lying to get Ambien from him, and who basically gave me enough Ambien to go kill myself and said, I can't treat you anymore, and I think you know why. Never said rehab, never said addict. And this guy is considered a great addiction expert out there, you know, making a name for himself. So sometimes it's ignorance, sometimes it's malice, but most of the time I believe it's ignorance. Do you?
So, yeah, I think that it's a systems problem more than anything. So I would agree with your assessment that by and large, the majority of prescribers that we have in society have the best of intent. They didn't go to medical school to harm people, the vast majority of them. However, we have a system that is driven by money. And that system, by and large, is driven by big pharma. And so if you look at how we got to where we're at today, 1996 was the implementation of pain as a fifth vital sign, where everybody who went into an emergency room, it was treated as a vital sign. What is your pain on the pain scale? And the goal at that time was that everybody's pain needed to be zero, an absolute zero. And part of the reason for that was that patient satisfaction surveys were put in place and compensation for physicians and hospitals were based upon scores on those patient satisfaction surveys. So if they weren't scoring appropriately because their pain was a zero, their compensation was affected. So that was the goal. And coincidentally or not, on that same year, that's when OxyContin came on the market. And OxyContin's aggressive marketing campaign is being effective for long-term management of chronic pain, non-addictive is what they were touting it out as first. And their marketers targeted what they were finding to be historic over-prescribers of opioids, because they knew that those were going to be the people who prescribed the greatest amount of OxyContin. Well, naturally, those people tended to be those who were less discerning about what they were prescribing. And so the problem spiraled out of control very, very quickly. And then eventually when they started to reel it back, that's when everybody turned to heroin. So I think that the problem by and large is that these physicians were just falling in line behind what the prescribing practices were. It wasn't malicious. They were just doing what they were told.
That's so interesting. I didn't know a lot of that. Another thing that I think, you know, pain is a very bizarre thing because it's the perspective of the person in pain. What I call pain may not be what you call pain. And as Americans, as human beings, we want to go in somewhere and have a solution. So leaving with a prescription is a solution as opposed to some sort of nebulous conversation about, I don't know, my pain is at a level 4. So I think there's something inherently, and I don't know if it's American or human, that just wants to feel, it feels like a waste to just go in, see a doctor and not come out with any specific diagnosis. But diagnosing pain is extremely complicated and vague.
No, you're absolutely correct. And I always want to be sure that the work that I do isn't intended to lessen somebody's quality of life, because what we had happen was there was a huge population of chronic pain sufferers who were sold this lie, and they were put on enormous doses of opiate medication. Well, because they've been on that for so long, they're not going to be able to go back to a different solution because their brain and their body is physiologically different than it was because they've been on opiates for so long. So they don't have the natural ability to reduce pain that many of us do. And so those people are being hurt along the way with this process. And so the only reason that I bring that up is that I think that it's really important that we bring that into the conversation around what this looks like and really promoting alternative methods of pain relief from the very, very beginning, because had a large portion of those people been given an option initially, they wouldn't be where they were at today. And I do think that we're looking at what is an American problem. I mean, we make up just over 4.5% of the world's population, and we're consuming over 80% of the world's total supply of opiates. We're consuming over 99% of the world's total supply of hydrocodone. So we are a society that wants to numb. And when I talk about addiction, I oftentimes don't make it specific to opiates. That was my drug of choice, but we see addiction on the rise across the board. Our society is just looking to medicate. So we have 50% more people today that meet criteria for alcoholism than we did in 2001. Methamphetamine is on the rise in many states at a greater rate than opiates. And over 50% of teens who have a cell phone now meet criteria for cell phone addiction, where they actually have a visceral reaction and their stress levels spike if it's taken from them. And so it's been proven that that addiction can lead to negative outcomes in a number of areas, including increased likelihood of substance abuse. So when I talk about this, I talk about what is an addiction pandemic that is specific to our society. And we are just looking to numb. And I haven't even gotten started on pornography yet. So that's a whole nother issue.
Good. This is fantastic. And Joe Schrank, I have this comment up here, but Americans think they're entitled to a pain-free existence. Life hurts. Get with it. Sometimes we feel how we feel, and it doesn't always need correction. Couldn't agree more. Couldn't subscribe to that more. If I'm ever remotely unhappy, I think there's something terribly wrong and I've got a lot to figure out, as opposed to, oh yeah, this is the breadth of experience of feelings of being a human being. I think addicts in general, you know, I think that we are people who think we're entitled to just feel good all the time, and something's terribly wrong if we don't. Whereas many people just accept that, you know, it's sort of like peaks and valleys. one thing I wanted to ask you, and it, so my belief about addiction is sort of, it's yes, we're genetically predisposed, but our circumstances in our formative years either sort of exacerbate or diminish that precondition. Are you somebody that believes addiction can just develop as a result of trauma with no genetic predisposition?
100%. And case in point, I'm sitting before you today as an example of that. So I'm actually going to give an example that I was speaking at an event in Phoenix this summer, and a gentleman waited afterwards to speak to me. And there's usually a few people who wait, and he waited until the very end, and I could just see something was off about his energy. He had a service animal with him and a woman to his side. And he waited until the end, and he came up to me and he said, "I just want to let you know, I was really moved. I came to see you talk today on the SWAT team that went in to climb, and we were the first into the library after the shooting." And I got emotional and he got emotional and we hugged each other and I thanked him, and he said, "You know, I am now a person in long-term recovery. And I just want to let you know that of the 16 people who went in to the library that day, I'm only one of two that are still alive, and 10 died by either overdose or suicide." And that is the SWAT team. So those are people who are trained professionals carrying weapons that were actually never directly in the line of fire. They just walked into a library that was riddled with bodies of innocent students. And that trauma was so profound. There's no way I would ever believe that all of those people just had a genetic predisposition for addiction. We were talking about professionals. They obviously weren't in active addiction at the time because they were working in the police force on a SWAT team. So I truly believe that addiction is the catalyst for the vast majority of addictions. And not only just how we define trauma, but I also talk about emotional pain, because oftentimes people hear trauma and they're like, "I don't have trauma. I'm good." Well, when we talk about emotional pain, that can look in a number of different ways, and that is increasing the susceptibility of addiction. And I think that's a big problem in our society with the rise in the addiction pandemic and the rise in mass shooting, because the trauma and the emotional pain that ripples off of events like that, even with the story I just told, imagine the trauma that those families sustained for the people who overdosed or the people who committed suicide. And I think that that's a huge problem in how we've gotten to where we're at today.
By the way, you were breaking up a little bit. If you guys are having any trouble hearing or seeing us, just let me know in the comments. I am going to read Joe. Some are made and some are born. Environment matters. There were many guys in Vietnam who were heroin addicts while in combat, and they gave it up after they were out of immediate life-threatening situations. Some were able to stop. This speaks to how little we empirically know about addiction. Agreed. Now, at what point did you realize your addiction was out of control, or was it something your parents realized and shipped you off somewhere?
So my parents realized very, very early on. I have wonderful parents, and they were, doing their best to help me. They didn't have a whole lot of understanding about addiction either. And so they knew very early on that something was wrong, and I had access to a bunch of help. The problem is all of the feedback from clinicians were, "He's just shut down. We can't reach him. He's going to have to engage in the stages of grief eventually. He's not responding to treatment right now." The feedback was never, "Let me talk to his primary care physician. Let me find out what medications he's taking," because it's pretty clear that he is numbing. And so I very quickly did a 180. So I tended to be a pretty compliant child, aside from my, skipping class to play golf. That was about the worst of it. And I immediately fell into a friend group that supported the behaviors that I wanted to exhibit. So I went life in the fast lane. I would do whatever it took to not have to feel present, because when I felt present, that would make me engage with the emotions that I didn't want to feel. And so very soon, what started as prescription turned to alcohol, marijuana, illicit narcotics. My drug of choice was more. I just wanted more of anything and everything. And my senior year, as an injured survivor, I had the ability to get a private tutor who brought my schoolwork to my home, and she came for 2 hours a day, 3 days a week. So my total accountability in my senior year was 6 hours a week. And that allowed me to continue to spiral in my addiction. I started to rebel from my parents, stay out all night, not coming home for days. And very, very quickly, I was on a path that took a long time to recover from. And then my first attempt at treatment was at the urging of my wife at the time, my employer, and my parents. And that was in 2006. And I went for 30 days because I wanted to get people off my back. So I went for all the wrong reasons. But that was when I first got that spark of, I'm not an addict, but these stories sound really familiar. Like the things that these people are saying sound really, really familiar. And then the process continued from there.
Did you stay sober after that one at all?
No, went right back to what I was doing, continued to hit new rock bottoms. And then in 2008, I went to treatment for 90 days. And at that point, I got 8 months. And so I started to go through the process. I said, yes, I'm an addict. I get it. I understand. I'm ready. I'm bought into this. And because of the work that I was doing, all these things started to come back into my life. So I was estranged from my wife at the time and my young son. They came back into my life through the family process. We were able to reconcile our marriage. I got my job back. All of these things started to come back into my life. And I'm like, oh my God, I've got this made. Life is wonderful. I can probably drink again. And so that thought process started to spiral. And I convinced myself that, you know what, I was a prescription addict. I never really had a big problem with drinking. It wasn't my thing. And I started drinking again. And I did that for about 2 weeks and my life didn't fall apart. And I said, see, look, I got it made. I got this made. I live in Colorado. I can smoke weed. And so it started to spiral. So I started smoking weed again. And then a few weeks later, I was inebriated. I was out. Somebody had a Xanax. I said, give me a Xanax. And while I was high on that Xanax, I called somebody who I knew had Oxycontin, which was my drug of choice. So I was right back in that spiral. And then from there, new rock bottoms. Finally, on April 2nd, 2011, I woke up in Denver City Jail with no recollection of how I got there. I was at Rocky's opening day, and I don't remember anything after 10 a.m. I was told later in the police report that I passed out at a restaurant. They called the paramedics. I had a warrant for a probation violation, which was my third on the same case. And I remember waking up, and I called my parents, and they wouldn't take the call. I called my wife at the time. She wouldn't take the call. And I called everybody in my life who I called a friend at that time, and nobody would pick up. I said, well, I'm on my own. I was 29 years old, and I had no ability to manage my life. And so I remember looking up treatment center for people who treatment centers don't work for. Like, tell me how I'm going to figure this out. I had very, very minimal resources at that time. I had extinguished all of my lifelines. And fortunately, I found a place that could take me in at no out-of-pocket cost. And I stayed in a continuum of care for 14 consecutive months. And that is really what it took to put me on the path that I'm on today is that continuum of care that allowed me to resolve that trauma at the strangest times. Like it would bubble up and I would go through this emotional catharsis that I should have been going through a decade before. But if I hadn't been in an environment of accountability and safety, I would have relapsed. No doubt about it in my mind. And fortunately today, April 2nd, 2011 is still my sobriety date.
Now, what would you tell people who can't go away for 14 months? What do you have any sort of tips for dealing with trauma on a day-to-day basis?
Well, the first part and one of the things that I say in most of the work that I do is you have to find the courage to lean into the pain. And what I mean by that is sometimes you just have to sit in it. It's not going to be easy. And I think we get back to that idea of like, as Americans, like we want to just feel good all the time. Like if I could be a zero on the pain scale, well, that's better than a three. I pick the zero. Sometimes you got to sit in the three and you got to sit in it for long enough to where you come out on the other side. And so a big part of the work that I do today is talking about the principles of post-traumatic growth and talking about how, if you can find the courage to lean into the pain, you will come out the other side. It takes time and it is a process and you have to trust that process. But when you come out on the other side, post-traumatic growth states that you can actually have meaningful development of personal character. So you're never going to be who you were before the trauma, but you can actually be better. You can actually refine certain aspects of your life to be better. And that's very, very clear in my life and the work that I do today, because there's no way I'd be sitting before you right now if it wasn't for post-traumatic growth.
And what about EMDR and these sort of, have you done some of those sort of therapeutic trauma techniques?
Absolutely. So now in my work today, I'm the COO of a Foundry Treatment Center in Steamboat Springs, and we are a trauma integrated long-term continuum of care. EMDR is a big part of our program. And so in looking at modalities that treat trauma, everything from equine therapy. I mean, we offer horticultural therapy and a wide spectrum of things that can work. What we find is that everybody adapts or everybody attaches to something more than the other. And so really, when you're looking at treating addiction, having that kind of multimodality approach where you can make sure that you're giving people enough attempts to be able to resolve what it is that they're dealing with, because there is not one size fits all for anything in regards to addiction treatment, specifically with trauma resolution. And so I think that that is super important in being able to, you know what, if you try five things and they don't work, try five more, because you're going to find that thing.
I'm going to put Missy's comment up on the screen. Missy says, got addicted to pills due to having migraines since teen years. At 47, I found out I had an orange-sized brain tumor. I wasn't crazy about my headaches, but maybe the doctor should have tested my head before drugs. Been clean ever since removal with the help of recovery, 6 years now.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
What's interesting is I never even count this as part of my addiction because it was so separate, but I had a headache my 16th year of life, the entire year, and was sent to doctor after doctor, couldn't figure out what was wrong. And I was eventually sent to a neurologist who put me on Darvocet, an opiate so intense that it's not even around anymore. Yeah. And I remember taking it and going, wow, I feel so good. Is that the absence of pain? Is that like, cause I didn't understand euphoria, drug, mm-hmm. And I built up such a huge tolerance so quickly that they just quickly had to put me on another one. But this also reminds me of this documentary I was watching last night, Heal. Have you heard of this?
I have not. I've not seen that.
Oh, you've got to. Tommy Rosen sent out an email about it, and you buy it. It's $10 on iTunes. It is basically, and they interviewed Deepak Chopra and Marianne Williamson and all of these people. And it's all of these people who have everything from cancer to fibromyalgia to migraines to anything else, and how it's so many of the principles of recovery that help them heal. Which isn't to say this is like woo-woo shit, like this is how you get rid of cancer, but it was a lot about like community and changing your diet and doing all of these things. Anyway, shout out. I got nothing to do with this film. Austin, you guys watching, Missy, Joe, you're going to, even Joe, even my cynical friend Joe is going to love it. I'm kidding. Now we have to get close to wrapping up. Is there anything? Okay. So I do want to talk a little bit about your speaking. Do you sort of travel year round speaking?
So yeah, I mean, I'm involved in a number of projects right now. I'm traveling about 30% of the time, and I have to keep it at that, cause I'm obviously the work that I'm doing in Steamboat is first and foremost. And then, I'm on the board of directors for a new public recovery high school in Denver that I'm super excited about. We'll be opening in the second quarter of next year. That'll be public, accessible to everybody, with a curriculum that's focused on project-based learning, whole body wellness. We're going to start educating kids about adverse childhood experiences so we can normalize those conversations in adulthood. And then I'm on the board of directors for the treatment center that saved my life, a 140-bed nonprofit called Stout Street Foundation in Denver, Colorado, that can take people into services at no out-of-pocket cost, and they leave debt-free with a savings account. So pretty phenomenal work being done in that regard. And the remainder of my time is speaking and advocacy work. And I've been involved in the Colorado Dental Association developing new prescribing practices to limit the number of dead meds that are in people's medicine cabinets, because a study that was recently done out of Pennsylvania indicated that over 50% of the dead meds were from old oral surgery. So dentists are really starting to look at the way that they're prescribing and trying to dial that in. So I'm definitely passionate about the work that I get to do today on a number of levels, and exciting stuff. So,
and let me ask you this. Are you in touch with anybody from Columbine? Do you hear from people, other survivors?
So not particularly. That's a great question, and it's one that I get often. So kind of after Columbine, that was really what defined all of our high school experience. And so for the longest time, I wouldn't even tell people I went to Columbine, because it would just start the whole question dialogue. And I think a lot of people did that. But really, everybody kind of scattered all over the country. However, we're at a point right now where, because of the way that this trauma is affecting so many people as a result of these events of mass shootings, mass violence, I think there's an enormous amount of value in getting those people back together. And so actually for the 20th anniversary of Columbine, A&E is working on a project. It's a raw documentary series that'll be a multi-episode series where it's going to kind of get some of those people back together. And it's a project I'm excited to be involved with.
Well, Austin, I cannot thank you enough. This has been just illuminating and fantastic. And this will be released, if you're watching this now, this will be released as one of my podcast episodes. My podcast is called Recover Girl. You can get it on iTunes and all that, all those places. And that's it. Unless, do you have anything you want to add, Austin?
No, I mean, thank you so much for having me today. We could probably continue this conversation for another 3 or 4 hours. So it was great. I think that we got through quite a bit.
Don't tempt me with that, or I will keep you for.
Hey, there's always next week.
Thank you. Thank you. See you guys next week. And thank you so much for watching. And thank you, Austin. Bye. Thank you.